You live in this building?
Yes.
Okay, we're somewhere on this floor. Very good. Who are you from home? What's your maiden name? From? Ah, hello. Hi, Weinberg from Kansas. Okay, I'm going to record myself too, if that's okay. If you don't mind.
So those of you who got the email already know who Rabbi Paltiel is.
Okay. Well,
if you didn't get the email, we'll find out as soon as you hear some words of wisdom.
Okay.
This is Paltiel's a very special lecture. So we'd love to hear at our heights. And Rabbi Feldman and I figured that if he came to learn with us, he would benefit a lot from it.
Ready to roll? We're starting?
I'm ready.
Okay, good. Okay, so now I've been recorded three times. Okay, anybody else have any machines? I actually have this lecture on tape. I can put the tape down and leave. You can all come back later and pick up your machines. Okay, now, in the modern world, everything has to be interactive. So these pieces of paper are going to make us interactive, if you so desire. Okay, put this piece of paper down. What is the expression? Write whatever you want, just don't write late for dinner. Okay. There was this young Jewish kid who grew up in America in the 1930s. He was a very, very big troublemaker. Okay. Every Jewish kid in the 1930s name was Herbie or Abe. So we'll call him Herbie. And his parents sent him to a school. And in a matter of several weeks, the school decided that he was a danger to himself and a danger to the school. So they sent him home. So his parents sent him to a second school. In the second school, he lasted 6 days. And eventually his parents ran out of schools, no public schools, no private schools. So by default, they sent him to a Catholic school. Well, these were not exactly rabbis, Hasidim. But sending a Jewish boy to a Catholic school wasn't the first thing on their agenda. But they figured, what choice did they have? Nobody else wanted him. So they send this kid to the Catholic school, and lo and behold, he was an angel. He behaved, didn't make any trouble, came to school, and he had his books, and his homework, and his pencils, and his pads, and he just did his work. And his parents were waiting for the other shoe to drop. You understand? They figured sooner or later something's going to happen, and he's going to show his true colors, and a week becomes a month, becomes a month. Finally, his parents tell him one day, I don't understand you. Herbie, we sent you to the best schools. They couldn't hold you more than a few days. How come you're surviving so well in the Catholic school? He said, well, really, I woke in both of these schools. They looked like zoos, acted like an animal. He says, I walked into the Catholic school, I saw that boy hanging on the wall. I knew they mean business. I grew up like any other Jew. Out of curiosity, opening up books of Kabbalah and seeing pictures of people hanging on the wall, if you know what I'm trying to describe. You know, the man who's in the middle of doing a jumping jack, and there's a big circle around him, and there's triangles, and circles in the triangles, big circles and little circles, and triangles within triangles. I reckon you know what I'm describing. This is your comment?
I don't know.
I speak telepathy, but I do it in private. Okay, it's cool. And you look at these pictures, Kabbalah. I never knew this was part of our religion. You know, funny looking configurations of human beings, males, females, circles, vertical lines, horizontal lines, Mug and Davids, half Mug and Davids, quarter Mug and Davids, and so forth. And like everybody else, I was curious, but I have to be honest, that as a little boy, I got bored of looking at the same three pictures. It's not like Kabbalah offers you a lot of variety. It's the same picture over and over and over again. But so many people have a fascination with Kabbalah. That's the bottom line. So many people have a fascination with Kabbalah. It's just one of those things. Talk to a person about Judaism, he doesn't do me a favor. The goy up the street's more interested than I am. talk about Kabbalah and everyone's ears go up and the tail starts to wag. What is it? What is it about Kabbalah that's got everybody's attention? What is it about Kabbalah that has everybody's attention? So I gave you pieces of paper. I want you to tell me what you think. Take a piece of paper. I have a pen and a pencil and time. I'd like to hear what you have to say. What's your opinion? What's your opinion? Now, don't put your name down, okay? So I won't know who you are. And I'll read your papers, and then we'll see what develops. In other words, you're going to set the agenda, sort of. You want to put all the machines on hold while people write things down? You're welcome. I want to hear what you have to say.
This is why we think it's popular?
Well, it's a philosophical question. Why does it have an appeal to you? Is it for a more relevant question? Right? You want a piece of paper?
Yeah. Assuming that we have an appealing to us.
And you're entitled to say, I have no idea and I think everybody's nuts. Which is not so far from the truth anyway. The good thing about being crazy is you always have plenty of company. No. You should send me a copy, I guess. You're working for the rabbi or you're working for yourself?
Rabbi.
Good, okay. I don't want to start up with the rabbi. We're actually related. His mother and my father are first cousins. It's like the rest of Lubavitch.
So did you narrow, what's this specific question, or did you, what exactly did you ask?
I want to know why you think it is that people are so enamored with Kabbalah, and if relevant, why you personally, particularly, are enamored with Kabbalah. I'd like to hear your opinion on the matter, that's all. I have my opinion on the matter, right? I'd like to hear yours. Okay, while I'm waiting, what's your name?
Rachel.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Joseph.
Hi.
Yes.
Frank.
Frank. Yossel. Mm-hmm. Joseph. Yeah. Jenna.
Hello.
Chana. Okay, and you are?
Keith.
Keith. Okay, Shmuel, that's a chain.
Yes.
Yosef Yitzchak or Yosef? No. I'm Yosef Yitzchak. Go ahead.
Jonathan.
Yehuda.
Yehuda?
Yeah.
Oizer.
Oizer. Now, if I was a genius, I'd remember your name, right? Hey, you're Rachel. Go ahead, what's your name?
Uri.
Uri.
Lindsay.
I'm sorry?
Lindsay.
Lindsay, yes. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Avram.
Didier.
Didier, that's French.
Didier.
Yeah, you forgive me, Americans can't speak French. I mean, like, really, you gotta speak French. Even if they know the language. What is your name, sir?
Lev.
Lev, hello. Okay. And I'm Yosef, or Yosef, Yossel, or Joseph, or Joe, whatever works. Okay. You got any responses? Thank you. Thank you very much. What was it? Frank, you told me your name was?
Frank.
Frank. Right. Okay.
Was the question, why are people intrigued by Kabbalah?
That's right. Why are they so intrigued?
Why are Americans?
No, people, and specifically you. Let's consider Americans part of the human race, huh? Just for this evening, if you don't mind. Tomorrow we'll go on to call them Americans. Okay, I'll wait a few more minutes. A few more seconds. How many names do I remember? Keith. Cherry, something or other. Chatter. Okay. The false Shmuel. I know a few of the false Shmuel. You're Yosef. Ben Moshe. Okay. 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 I should have asked you to write in the bottom of your paper, do you mind if I make fun of you? Thanks for permission. It doesn't say your name, so. Hi. What is your name, sir?
Rafael.
Okay, hello. Are we done? Everybody is into responding, has responded? Thank you. You sound very religious.
You heard that, Rabbi? I'm just accused of being very religious in my response.
No, you can't know who's who over here.
I forgot, I mixed them up.
You should have looked at my thing, yes.
I'm sorry, terrible mistake. Okay. Okay, here we go. Okay, I put them into whichever order I chose. Okay, if you came late, I'm sorry, you're not entitled to an opinion. Okay, that's the way it works. What's your name, sir? Hi.
My name
is Rachamim. I'm Yosef. Yosef. I'm going to read what you wrote, okay? I am interested in Kabbalah because it deals with spirituality and mysticism. Mystery. Unknown, two words, two nouns. The mystery and the unknown. Okay. Universal truths, defining mysteries, and after each of those there's several dots, and then it says, describes common human experiences. That's quite a dichotomy. Universal truths defines mysteries, as at the same time, it describes common human experiences. Then it says, what sustains the world. Here, I'm not into Kabbalah. Would you please leave? No. Okay. But the world is, because they know that it is the oldest of knowledge, when they feel, I guess, which they feel is reliable connection to the Jewish Torah, which is the only truth. Okay, yeah, you sound like a fanatic. Okay, so am I, by the way, so you're good company. Okay, Kabbalah is the science of spirituality. In our time, parenthesis, messianic age, end the parenthesis, a new higher desire has awakened humanity, a desire to rise above our corporeal world, unite with each other and the Creator. Okay, that's very idealistic. I think that Kabbalah, quote, peels, end of quote, away the outer garments of Torah, in quotes, to reveal its soul. Okay, personally, to understand the Torah more thoroughly, and public, it seems to offer easy to understand secrets. I guess an easy method of understanding secrets. Okay, that's it. That's the whole list. So how many categories of definitions do we have? Clearly, Kabbalah discusses mystery, secrets, the unknown. That's pretty clear, right? Everybody seems to agree with that. One person says Kabbalah enlightens the everyday aspects of our lives. I agree with that also, by the way. It reveals what sustains the world. They consider it the oldest form of knowledge, the science of spirituality. You guys should all become writers, by the way. Okay, it peels away the outer layers of the Torah, and it seems to offer a way to understand secrets. This is a pretty good list. I've done this many times before, and I got some very, very pertinent responses from people. These responses are, what's the word? They're not very revealing. I can't make fun of you with these. This is a stat. You know, people wrote things like, "It explains to me why I suffer," or "It explains to me the process of searching for my soulmate." I mean, really intimate things. And also not necessarily such positive things. I don't think there's any pain in almost any of these pages. You know, you're a good group. Rabbi, you've got it right where you want him. A lot of people, when they discuss, remember, this is anonymous. Nobody here has given their names, and I know how to read handwritings, but I've suspended gift until I actually learn how to do it. So I don't know who you are, and I don't think there's any bitterness in any of these notes, which I find quite interesting, personally. Now you, I know who you are, because you just handed me the paper. Okay, but this is, it's closed. I refuse to take any more papers. I find Kabbalah to be far too esoteric to have practical application. I am much more concerned with halacha and studying Gemara. I would like to have my view challenged, though. Okay. I am interested by Kabbalah on a cursory level, though I would say that I am much more concerned with halacha. Okay. I hear that. Okay. It's a great joke. I'm sorry, but I have to tell you the joke. There are three people sitting on a bench. And the first fellow is sitting doing like this. He reaches out to the heavens and pulls something down. The person sitting next to him is sitting there in great concentration, and he's doing the reverse motion. He's throwing these imaginary things up into the sky. The third person is sitting near them going, so this fellow walks up to the first person and says, "What are you doing?" He says, "Can't you see? I'm hauling in the stars. I'm pulling in the stars." He says to the second person, "And what do you do? Can't you tell? I'm putting them up into the orbit." And he says to the third person, "What are you doing? These guys are crazy. I'm getting out of here." Okay. If I had to give you a psychological answer or a psychological opinion, I agree with everything that's written here, including the person who says he doesn't like Kabbalah. I agree with that too. Everybody's right, because there's a place for Kabbalah, and there's also a place to understand the limits of the exploitation of Kabbalah. If I had to give you my personal opinion on a psychological level, I would propose to you people are interested in Kabbalah because they believe it's going to give them some peace.
Can you speak a
little louder? Huh? I can't hear you. I'll try. Why don't you move up closer? Yeah. Young people in the back. That's my personal feeling. My feeling is we're desperately in search of peace. And we're willing to try a lot of interesting possibilities, alternatives, options in the pursuit of that. And, you know, and the big issue with peace. The big issue with peace, the problem with not our neighbor and our friend and even our family. The problem with peace is ourselves. The struggle to find a place of harmony and, you know, what Torah calls Sameach Bechelko, being satisfied with your lot. You know, the hand that God has dealt me is fine. It's such a simple thing, and in reality, it's incredibly elusive, especially in a world like ours, which is so busy and so full of people and so full of advertising and so full of opportunity and materialism. I think that that's what people want. People want to step off the train for a moment and find a little peace. And I think they believe, and perhaps it's true, that Kabbalah is going to provide them a little bit of peace. But I made myself my own list, okay? This is nobody's list in particular. And again, I want to reiterate, I have done this on a number of occasions. I've spoken about Kabbalah many times. And on many circumstances where I raise this question and I ask people to hand me back anonymous notes, I got some pretty painful responses. I would make the case that most of you are pretty healthy people. Some people, you know, there's so much pain, unfortunately. And they somehow see Kabbalah, I don't know what, as a cure, as an escape, a little bit of both. I don't see any pain in anybody who's had the courage to write an anonymous note telling me their opinion. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing. It's good not to be in pain. If you'd be in pain, I suppose it would be communicated. So on my whole list, okay, I'm going to give you the short version of the list. And then I'm going to go through each one of these items individually, specifically in detail. And if another opportunity arises, we'll actually stop talking about Kabbalah until I bore you, and then it'll be time to move on to a different speaker. But that's my intent. Okay, I'll read you my short list. People are interested in Kabbalah because it provides a form for spirituality. I'll get back to it, okay? People are interested in Kabbalah because they believe, and correctly so, that through the model, through the discipline, through the philosophy of Kabbalah, they can affect self-improvement. They can become better people. People are interested in Kabbalah because Kabbalah provides beauty to life in general, to the world at all, and to the religion. Kabbalah makes Judaism beautiful, pretty. Not, don't do this, and behave, now you keep quiet for the next 10 minutes. Kabbalah makes Judaism beautiful, it does. Number four, and this is probably the ultimate, and I guess some of you alluded to it, people are interested in Kabbalah because they believe that they want to find a truth, with a capital T, an absolute truth, which is of course a very subjective and greatly debated, a hot issue. And lastly, people are interested in Kabbalah because they believe that Kabbalah is going to provide them with a purpose for themselves, a definition of their existence. So this is what we're going to talk about. I want to go through each one of these and share some insights. You're welcome to interrupt me as long as you don't say anything that I don't approve of. Okay? You're the rabbi, a list of things not to raise. If you have something to say, you're welcome to say it. Incidentally, the rabbi mentioned to me that a lot of you have questions on matters of Kabbalah. You're welcome to write those down. If you have no more blank pieces of paper, I still have some blank paper, and hand them up. And of course, I have the option of ignoring you, the option of responding, depending on whether it serves my purposes or doesn't serve my purposes, right? The way of the world. So let's start from the beginning. People are interested in Kabbalah because it provides a form for spirituality. Okay. What is spirituality? Does anybody know what spirituality is? Well, some people, like our friend over there, probably would say, spirituality is nonsense. It's a waste of time. It's a bunch of weirdos escaping the reality of the world by imagining that there's something out there. If you believe in the phenomena of spirituality, even if you believe in spirituality, it becomes an incredibly difficult thing to define. So what does it mean? Spirituality. What is the concept? What is the framework? How does something fit into the box, into the criteria, into the category of spirituality? Spirituality is not material. It's not real. It's not physical. In my view, people have a curiosity, are intrigued by Kabbalah. Because Kabbalah actually gives spirituality a face. That's what it does. It doesn't just say it's metaphysics, acharei hateva, as Jewish theologians call it, acharei hateva, which means beyond nature. That's the Hebrew term, that's the theological term amongst Jewish philosophers for metaphysics. It's beyond physical, it's beyond the real world. You know what they call it? The para-real. So what is it? Nobody knows. Kabbalah puts a face on spirituality. It structures it. You know, there's an east and a west and a north and a south and an up and a down. I don't know exactly where I'm going and where I came from, but there is a form. Imagine yourself a free fall, right? What does free fall mean? It doesn't mean you're falling off a building. That's not free fall. That's traveling towards gravity. If you're in space, you're nowhere and going nowhere. There's no sense of motion because your body is not existing in relation with any other body. You're just existing. Where are you headed? Nowhere in particular. When you're going to get there? I'm in no particular rush. Spirituality is an intangible. What is it? And as ironic, as strange as it is, so many people are convinced of the reality of the of metaphysics. There's a truly spiritual dimension. Not just somewhere, but there's a truly spiritual dimension to our lives. And we're curious about spirituality. And the way I envision it is, if you're in freeze fall, you want to just, you know, every million miles, you'd like to see a stop sign. You know, you have just traveled a million miles, moving at 18,000 miles an hour, or whatever it is. Some sense of direction, some sense of, you know, you've gone from point A to point B. And Kabbalah clearly defines structure, form to spirituality. Now, when Kabbalah provides form for spirituality, the form isn't spiritual. Form is never spiritual. Form is always limiting. But the form provides a context on spirituality. In other words, you know, when is spirituality good and when is spirituality bad? When is spirituality appropriate and when is spirituality excessive? How do you answer these questions? And Kabbalah is a discipline that provides for us a framework that allows us to interpret spirituality and to have a sense of good spirituality versus evil spirituality, appropriate spirituality versus inappropriate spirituality, and so forth. And I think we're intrigued by spirituality. Some people aren't. I mean, there are people, you know, the lawyers in this world couldn't care less. The accountants, I hope you're not a lawyer or an accountant and love Kabbalah, but sensitive people, I guess you can be a sensitive lawyer too on the weekends, if you have weekends off. Yeah. Sensitive people have a sense that spirituality is real. And what is spirituality? So let me use the soul as my frame of reference, okay? I suppose the most concrete question in spirituality is the question of the soul. Right? We live in the modern world. Everybody in this world lives in the modern world, right? I live in an ancient world. I just traveled through time into the modern world. When I stood outside this front building, it didn't look especially modern, to be quite honest. But okay, there's all kinds of modernity. And in the modern world, we question the whole phenomenon of a soul, right? Speak to a doctor, a biologist, a scientist. Soul nonsense. What's a living thing? Well, it's an organization of biomass that operates using electric currents. Yeah, but maybe there's something transcendent. Maybe there's more to an organism than just atomic particles arranged into an order of atoms and molecules and strings of molecules. And cellular parts and cells and collections of cells and limbs and organs and an integration, a unity, a harmony, which is absolutely incredible. And life is more than electric currents, the messages going, you know, from the brain to the eye to the hand to the foot and so forth. Perhaps there's something transcendent. Perhaps there's more to what being alive is than biology, than, you know. Of course, it's a centerpiece of any spiritual movement, any kind of a mysticism, will argue that there's a concept of a soul. A soul means everybody in this room is alive, right? Any doubts about that? Any objections? Anybody disagree? Everybody's alive, right? We all agree. What? I'm sorry, you object. Okay, good. I need it.
I hope so.
I hope so. Okay. Being alive means that our bodies are functioning, right? Our heart pumps blood, our stomach digests food, it processes it, it nourishes us, it regenerates, we're alive. The soul means that the meaning of being alive is more than just the biology. There's something transcendent. And spiritual people say, I wanna know that soul. You know, I wanna know that dimension of myself. And the question becomes, assuming that dimension exists, and of course, I don't think I have to convince you that Kabbalah not only believes in a soul, but makes the argument that Everything real is spiritual. You know, the biology, the physical reality, is simply an expression of life. And life is not biomass. Life is spiritual. Life is soul, is the transcendent. You want to access to that soul. And that's one of the things Kabbalah teaches. You've got a soul. Let me tell you what it's about. Let me tell you its basic tendencies. And now, see if you can incorporate the soul into your practical life. Can it have any bearing whatsoever on life in the real world? In any part of your life? I suppose if I had to categorize people who are in pursuit of spirituality, in other words, if I had to define people who want to know something about their soul, I would say they'd fall under two categories. And you're supposed to disagree with them. You have to say a minimum of three, otherwise one of us is not Jewish. There's got to be some kind of dissent. I would say some people are interested in the soul because they want to exploit it. They want to use it to their material advantage. Some people are interested in the soul because they want to become like the soul. They want to have more of an association with the realm of the soul, with the realm of the spiritual. But both wish for spirituality, for the soul to raise them up a notch. Their lives should be defined a little bit differently than simply things and experiences. The pursuit of pleasure, what they call in our culture, the pursuit of happiness. So let me give you a couple of ideas, right? Which I think they're universal ideas. I don't think I'm telling you anything you don't know. What's the soul? What is your soul? What is my soul? And if you disagree, you're really welcome to disagree. This is not, like I said, you only can disagree if I allow you to. But you're really totally entitled to have your own opinion, and you're even willing to permitted to voice it. I made myself a short list. Here's what I think about the soul. I think the soul is positive, optimistic, and trusting. I think the soul is kind. I think the soul is inspired, I mean motivated. The soul's got energy. The soul's not asleep, and the soul is certainly not depressed. And I think the soul is joyous. Okay? That was a list of eight, right? It's four categories. That's what I wrote down on my piece of paper. The soul is positive, optimistic, and trusting. How dangerous, huh? Think about it. What happens if we trust it, huh? It wouldn't work out so good in the, quote, real world. The soul trusts. We would like to be able to trust. I don't think that that's such a radical thing to say. Most people would like to create a micro world, a tiny environment where they can allow positiveness, optimism, and trust to emerge. We all like to be kind. I think that's pretty universal, although it's absolutely universal. Most people would prefer to be nice. We can afford it. We certainly would like to be inspired and not lethargic. And the soul is joyous. Joy is a funny word. I don't mean it haha funny. I mean it's an odd concept. Joy means all of the above. It means optimism, it means trust, it means energy, and it means kindness. And I think human beings have an inherent sense that spirituality is real. They can argue forever, you know. The Indians have been immersed in spirituality for millennia about how you define it. But I think that's the essence of most people have a sense of spirituality. Most people think of spirituality as pristine and as good. We're interested in spirituality because we want to have something to do with that realm, with that world, in spite of the reality of our lives. And we believe, perhaps correctly, that Kabbalah is going to teach us how. It's going to give us guardrails, it's going to give us steps, techniques, that will A, protect us, and B, permit us to walk into a world of spirituality. Because you don't want to walk into spirituality and land on your face. That's not very constructive. And we have a curiosity about spirituality. Most people don't take Kabbalah that seriously. You know, it's great for the weekend. I like to read about it. But to be very intense about it is another story. And I would agree with the good fellow there. I'm sorry, I remember everybody's names but yours, Avram, that Kabbalah by itself is a trip. It's not such a safe experience. If you're going to take Kabbalah very seriously, you better take the religion seriously, which means the practical day-to-day mitzvot. If you're really into the practical side of Judaism, Kabbalah will enhance it or intensify it. Kabbalah by itself can be it can be dangerous. So that's my first thought. I think we want spirituality. We all want spirituality because we have a sense that spirituality is a good thing. Some of us want spirituality because we want the truth of spirituality. Others of us want the spirituality because you want to exploit it. And we believe that Kabbalah is going to teach us how. Go ahead, Lev. Right?
Yeah.
I'm a pretty smart guy.
Yeah.
And humble. Go ahead.
Where the spiritual people I know are total idiots.
Thank you. Okay, so you disagree with my premise?
Well, I agree that it's dangerous, but I think that the people that maybe pursue spirituality are usually more equipped to deal with the world, so they kind of hide and think of spirituality.
Okay, so let's talk about the question. We're talking about Kabbalah. Do you believe there's any corollary between spirituality and Kabbalah?
I don't know.
Do you have any interest in Kabbalah?
Yeah,
why?
As a buzzword.
It's
like a famous word.
Okay, now, what about the way I define spirituality?
As like a positive, good thing.
Right.
I think it's possible.
Is that crazy? Is that reckless? Is that a reflection of being incapable to function in the real world?
No, I think that's a good way to describe spirituality. If that's a way to describe it, but who knows what it is.
Would you mind if I rephrase what you said,
yeah,
with your permission? It's a terribly rude thing to do. When people are engaged only in spirituality, they're idiots. When people live life and want something a little different, or something additional that they get from spirituality, it can be a constructive contribution to their practical life. Is that a reasonable interpretation of what you said?
I guess you have to be balanced. I mean, people are actually pursuing some kind of balance, and so maybe they go with spirituality and go with balance another way.
Okay. So we agree. Sort of.
Yeah,
okay. Now, item two on my list. Self-improvement. People are interested in Kabbalah because of self-improvement. Self-improvement, I'm dividing up into two categories. The first part of self-improvement is to come closer to God. A person interested in Kabbalah because he believes or she believes that the indulgence, the engagement, the exercise, the pursuit is a way of having more of a relationship with God. There's a lot of truth to that. I'm not so sure there's a lot of truth that people, in fact, are engaged in that. In other words, how many people are studying Kabbalah because they want to have a relationship with it? I would say very few. It's more and more popular in the modern era to dissociate Kabbalah from Judaism altogether, which is, in my opinion, incredibly tragic and distorted. But there are all of these movements, all these ideas that have made, as someone wrote, Kabbalah into almost like a science, like a self-contained body of knowledge. Some people are interested in Kabbalah because they believe it'll actually bring them closer to God, and I'm going to offer you some thoughts on this momentarily. Other people are interested in Kabbalah because it provides self-improvement on a human level, as a person. And I want to explain each of these two points separately, each one of these two points individually. First of all, people pursue Kabbalah in the belief that it'll bring them closer to God. Here's the problem with God. What's the problem with God?
asked me what's the problem with God.
You have no problems with God. We're friends. Pardon me?
Can
you have any relationship with him? You hit the nail right on the head. Thank you very much.
No,
I rehearsed
problem.
Well.
No problem.
He has no trouble with God. I heard a psychologist, a psychiatrist named Professor Landis speaking years ago. He was a Baal Tshuva from the, I don't know when, the 60s or the 70s. He grew up in Crown Heights in the early 1950s, across the street from 770, and he traveled all the way around the world till he met Lubavitch. And he said, I knew nothing about religion, he said. I knew nothing about religion. But I was searching for a rabbi. This is a great little story. How am I going to look for a rabbi if I have no idea what the religion is about? He says, so I went from rabbi to rabbi. I had a one-question test. And I took along my stopwatch. I go into a rabbi and say, Rabbi, do you believe in God? And I push the watch. Average length of answer, between 3 and 5 minutes. Depends, what does God mean, and how do you mean it, and how involved he is, and how uninvolved he is. Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday. He said, then he met Rabbi New from Long Beach. This is the early 1970s, late 1960s. He says, do you believe in God? And before I could push the watch, he said, yes. I like that. I don't understand why, but I just knew that that made sense. Somehow, being religious has to do with believing in God. You know, some people would think that religion is so complicated. But what's your name, sir? Joe. Joe. You have to think about it for a while. I'm just messing with you. I think that the point that you made is so incredibly valid. This is not a philosophy class. I don't want to get all caught up, you know, about God. But I think God is the most abused truth that exists. Everybody's got an opinion on God. Everybody's got an opinion on God. Just read the cars that drive by in Brooklyn. And most people haven't given God more than 5 seconds of thought. I guess we could assume that, quote, if there is a God, end quote, it's a pretty complicated idea. You know, everybody understands that they don't know, abstract physics. Everybody agrees that they're not Einstein. They don't understand, you know, the idea that there's a relativism, there's a balance between energy and mass. And everyone's an expert on God. And God is the most difficult concept that can be imagined. And yet, we all seem to have him all figured out. We have our opinions about him and our attitudes and our moods and so forth and so on. God is incredibly maligned, if I may say so. And you know what? The good news is God doesn't mind. As long as we talk about it, he doesn't mind. But I agree with Joel about one thing. It's one thing to believe in God. It's another to have a relationship with him. Now, I'll tell you what I mean by a relationship. Good morning. He responded. He told me good morning back. Took him a while, but good morning. Having a relationship with God is really beyond our senses. We can't feel God. We can feel ourselves. You know, I can be excited about God, but my excitement is feeling me. It's not feeling God. And I want you to know that on a religious level, okay, one of the most important purposes of Kabbalah is to teach us the concept of the Ein Sof, which I'm not going to explain tonight. The Ein Sof is not God. Ein Sof is the light. That's what it's called. The purpose for Kabbalah talking about the Ein Sof is to say, you cannot feel God. You can feel His light. In other words, Kabbalah actually says that it's possible to experience godliness, to feel. One of the most difficult things to deal with as a religious person, God gave me rules, I'm doing what He said, I'm a good boy, I'm a good girl, I'm going to go to heaven, I'm not going to go to hell. But He gave me the rules, I'm doing the rules. There's no intimacy. I don't know Him on a personal level. I do what He says, but a personal relationship between a human being and God is impossible. Between a human being, between God and anything is impossible. He's transcendent. He's the truth. know, in the fancy world of Hasidic theology, which I don't know how familiar you are, they call him an existence that's non-existential. Chew that for a few seconds. And Kabbalah says, I can't make you intimate with God, but you can experience His light. You can experience a warmth. You can experience some kind of concept of godliness that I can consciously touch and feel in some place within my conscious and my soul. Pardon?
You don't mean the sun.
I don't mean the sun, but you learned a little chassidus. Huh? Learned a lot more, my brother. I understand. Of course I do. No, I don't mean that, no. The light of Ein Sof, whatever that means.
The light is within you.
Well, I tell my students, basically, you're pseudo-intellectual. I owe the rights to that. Nothing is simple. But yeah, your statement is well taken. People want to feel God, and Kabbalah teaches that. It genuinely does. The thing that you don't know about Kabbalah is, Kabbalah doesn't teach shortcuts. The shortcuts are all the modern inventions. The real thing is an incredible life. But Kabbalah is about having intimacy with God. And the person who wishes for self-improvement says, I'm studying Kabbalah. I want to be close to God. I've been practicing the religion. I've been seeing the Torah, like our Talmudist over here. Give me your name again.
I apologize, but I am going to take exception to some of the things that you're saying. I don't want to be misconstrued. I'm not saying that I don't like Kabbalah.
My brother, I'm messing with you.
Okay.
Don't take yourself seriously.
No, okay.
You got a sense of humor. I got a sense of humor.
No, it's fine. But you're
just tell me your name again.
Abraham.
Abraham, go ahead.
I'd like to take issue with one thing that you're saying. You're saying that the banality of the mitzvot and the dryness.
No, I'm not saying that.
But are you saying that it's prohibited, that you can't have that is not akin to that's not akin to a connection with Hashem?
It certainly is, but not a human connection. You can't feel God. You can feel yourself.
When I put the phone
in? Yeah.
I can't feel my relationship with
God. Yeah. You're feeling yourself on an emotional level, on a sensual level.
You can't physically feel God.
No.
You can't spiritually feel God. Listen, we don't have time to have this long discussion. I didn't make up this idea. This is a classic philosophical idea. If you're familiar with... In Jewish theology, there are basically two schools of thought. I'm going to put most of the people here to sleep. The mystics and the philosophers. And this is one of the central distinctions. Is there such a thing as being closer or from God? In philosophy, the answer is no. In philosophy, I mean Maimonides, the classics. And mysticism says yes. And that's what I'm discussing. The idea of actually experiencing, the right word is not feeling God. Feeling God is impossible. In the words of Rasag, Rabbi Sadi Gaon, to feel God, you have to be God. The problem of being God is that you stop being Avraham. It's a bit of a problem. Kabbalah says that you can experience the light. Yeah. And I don't mean emotional, I mean a real concept of Ein Sof. And this is not a simple trip. This is not simple. It's been made simple. It's been mass produced. It's been commercialized. It's been sold as some easy event. But people who are serious about this, it's a whole lifestyle. It's a very deep lifestyle.
Why can't you spiritually feel God? I mean, every spiritually feels God in this way.
I agree. But what you're really feeling is... I'm not disagreeing with you.
I thought you meant physically.
No. But when we feel spirituality, we're actually, I have to say it the way it is, we're feeling ourselves.
Yeah, and that is feeling God.
No, it's not.
Why not?
Because I'm me, I'm not God. The center of my world is my ego, not His. To make space in me for Him is an incredibly profound thing. Okay, now this is an introductory class. You have to come back next week and I'll teach you all the tricks. You wanted to say something. But please tell me your name.
No, I'll
fast. Okay. You want to wait till
I think you answered.
You wanted to say something.
I just want to say that I think it's... can you talk more about how there's a difference between religion and Kabbalah? And that you're stating it now, and I think that it's worth spending a little bit more time on, where religion, you have a faith-based system where you're outside of spirituality and you're doing the mitzvot, and you are feeling things, but you're feeling things in the human realm. And Kabbalah is the study of, it's a science of spirituality, where you enter into spirituality, where you have a tangible connection to God that is scientific in the sense that it's provable and it's tangible.
It's provable
internally, as opposed to religious observances that are based around your feelings and your faith. And so I think the more interesting conversation to have is, I think that in Hasidut they talk about that there's somehow that the mitzvot are transcendent of the physical realm, that the actual doing of the mitzvot does have some kind of magical spiritual power in themselves. But if you're talking strictly without talking about what, and I don't know enough because no, the Kabbalists differ from the religious in that they're saying that they're two separate, very different things. One of them, like you say, is tangible, where you can have a relationship with God, meaning you speak to God and God answers you back. And religion is something very different, which is just basically you doing a whole bunch of stuff because God told you to do it, and it's faith-based.
I need 45 minutes, yeah.
I know, I said a lot of time.
And the only thing I'm going to respond to is Kabbalah is religion. It's the soul of the religion. It's not apart from the religion. The separation of Kabbalah from religion is simple ignorance.
It's not separating in order to separate. It's separating so that you can understand.
Identify.
So
agree.
Identifying. All you're doing is saying, this is one thing and this is two things, two parts of the same whole, and it's a system that you want to work together, but you have to at least say, first you have to separate it so that you can identify it and you can understand what you're talking about. And you're saying, in Judaism, you synthesize the two, which is, no one wants to say that that's not true.
Right.
But you have to at least have a conversation where you understand the difference between what Kabbalah is and what religion is, so that you can then understand that Judaism is the synthesis of these two things, the inner aspect and the outer aspect.
Your point is well taken, and I'm going to permit myself to save that discussion for another occasion. So, the issue that we're addressing is self-improvement. And I really believe a lot of people study Kabbalah because of the issue of self-improvement. And the first aspect of self-improvement that I'm proposing is the idea that people believe, and I agree with it, at least in principle, that Kabbalah teaches you how to have an intimate relationship with God. And the second is human self-improvement. And here too, there are two aspects. Very interesting concept. In the modern world, and I'm going to get to this later soon, in the modern world, one of the greatest debates, is there such a thing as an absolute right and an absolute wrong? Is there absolute truth or absolute falsehood, or is everything relative, everything a point of view? And some people say that Einstein says everything is relative. We can argue about that too. And some say it's division of different modern schools of psychoanalytical thought. Is there a true definition of what a person is, or a person is whatever they are? One of the core teachings of Kabbalah is that there's an absolute right and wrong. There's an absolute healthy and unhealthy, correct and incorrect. Again, like I started the class, the picture of the man in the middle of his jumping jack with the circle around him and the lines running hither and thither and the triangles that hold, the image of the picture of Kabbalah that we all have from the encyclopedia revolves around the phrase supernal man. I'm sure you've heard the term. Adam ha'olam, supernal man. And it means that there is such a thing as the idyllic human, the perfect human being. I suppose if we needed to identify, some would say Adam and Eve, before they got themselves into trouble, were the prototypes, the archetypes, the perfect human beings. And of course the intellectuals right away are saying, well, if they were so perfect, had they sinned, so they must have been not so perfect, so the rabbi's wrong. And that's great to make the rabbi wrong. I love doing that. That's why I come to class. But anyway, Kabbalah believes in the idyllic model. In other words, we were created in an image. This image of God. The image of God is a perfect Adam, a perfect human being. If I had to articulate that in a word, and that's all I'm going to afford because of time restraints, a perfect human being is balanced, not extreme, not hyper. The essence of humanhood is balance. For those who've dabbled in Kabbalah, tiferet, beauty. Beauty is in balance. Polarity is not human. polarity is animalistic. Kabbalah teaches that there is an ideal image of man. Now we are all compromises of that. We're all sort of that. Like someone said before, does God have a beard? And don't have a beard, we have our own ideas. The supernal man is a theoretically perfect image of humanhood, which we have evolved from, we have descended from through the course of many generations and through much change. And in the course of that evolution, there's been partial corruptions, you know? Small things like anger. Ever heard of anger? I'm going to assume nobody here knows it personally, but you may have heard, may have read in a book that there's some people who have an issue called anger. Or paranoia. Heard of paranoia? Heard of paranoia? You know, these kind of diseases that they have. You know, the other people. But we're created in a godly image. This is the belief in Kabbalah that human beings have a theoretical possibility to be perfect. We ain't. We're not. You know, when you read the Bible, people lived hundreds and hundreds of years. And we can argue whether they achieved perfection or not, but we're not living hundreds and hundreds of years, right? And some people would say that's not a bad thing, by the way. But we'll talk about that on another occasion also. But this is an idea. Kabbalah teaches us how a person is supposed to be. Now, what am I? That's another story. But the fact that Kabbalah provides a concept of an ideal human being is very meaningful to us. I think. And on a psychological level, not just on a wacky spiritual, the idea that Kabbalah says there is a perfect way for a human being to be. We're not perfect. And when you study Kabbalah and you analyze this model of the perfect man, the perfect image, and by the way, I'm sure everybody understands that man doesn't mean as opposed to woman. Man is the generic use of the word man. Human. It puts a balance, it puts a center into our lives, it puts a center even into our morality, into our ethics. And we say to ourselves, okay, I want to be a little more perfect. I want to reflect just one drop more the man in whose image I was created. And it's been distorted by my mistakes, by my parents' mistakes, by my grandparents' mistakes, by history's mistakes, by a bad teacher in kindergarten. This is another aspect of self-improvement that makes Kabbalah have such a broad appeal. People want to study Kabbalah because it gives them an idea of what I would be if I was the way I'm supposed to. And then we can wish. Everybody knows what wishing is worth. And we can maybe do something about it. And there's another area of self-improvement. This is a painful area. And as I told you, none of us reflect pain. Which, again, either none of you are being honest or all of you have wonderful lives. A lot of people are into Kabbalah because of that magic word, tikkun. Heard it before? Tikkun. You go to most Kabbalah lectures, they talk about tikkun. Tikkun means correction. People are trying to explain the frustrations in their lives. People are trying to explain the failure in their lives. People are trying to explain the suffering in their lives. And Kabbalah has answers. Mystical answers. You know, prior incarnations. All kinds of interconnections between us and other people, between us and our past, between us and our world. And the belief that human beings, I'm here, I'll say it even though I'm very uncomfortable with the concept, to struggle. And these struggles make us better. And the fact that these struggles make us better justify the struggles. Kabbalah talks an enormous amount about tikkun. And of course, the premise of tikkun, the premise of a need to correct, assumes imperfection. Assumes that something is not right, needs to be fixed. And we relate that back to Genesis, to Adam and Eve, the original sin. God created them perfect, and they didn't corrupt themselves. They corrupted history. And history, us, generations, we're all little, you know, peas in a pod, pieces in a puzzle. That live our lives and correct ourselves, correct history, correct our world. And what I just said is true. It's Kabbalistically true. personally, since people are offering personal opinions, I'll offer you my own personal opinion. The weakness, the problem I have with this, is that I am not comfortable with the notion of religion and Kabbalah having such a negative tone. The people who are into the Tikkun model of Kabbalah, it's very suffering based. And pardon my candor, it sounds quite Christian. Kabbalah is not about suffering. Tikkun, I'm sorry, is not about suffering. It's about correction. It's about frustration. It's about challenge. It's about trial and error. But it's about life. And life's not all bad. Kabbalah doesn't want life to be all bad. It's a piece of the puzzle. It's an aspect of self-perfection. So I've given you three insights. People study Kabbalah, reason number two, because they believe that it'll help them improve themselves. A, it'll give them a sense of relationship with God, which is a pretty ideal reason to pursue it. B, it'll make them better, either because they'll have a sense of what ideal is, and they can aspire for it, they can work on it, they can wish, they can dream. Or B, this concept of tikkun, that our struggles are going to heal us. Our struggles are going to make us better and greater human beings. And there's a lot of credibility to that. And nobody likes struggles. Nobody likes pain. And Kabbalah shows you the silver lining to the cloud. In effect, it helps you come to terms with it. It says you're not just suffering to suffer. There's a point. There's an end. So that's the second issue on my list. The third issue on my list, which is also quite meaningful and I think true, people study Kabbalah because they want to find beauty. Beauty in the world, beauty in Judaism, and beauty in their lives. And the reason Kabbalah provides beauty is because it raises you above. It lifts you to a place where you can afford beauty. In the real world, you've got to survive. And life's not that bad, by the way. People lived 300 years ago had a little harder than we do in all of our kvetching and our complaint. But that it provides beauty. I had a student years ago who was a PhD, she was a doctor, she was a professor of botany, of plants. She had a much fancier word than that. Ornithology, I don't know what it's called. And she sat in my class for a few months. She was a smart girl. Smart girls are wonderful. And when I finally discovered how educated she was, so I asked her if she looks at a flower, if she still sees beauty. And she went on for 45 minutes. You know, it's like a person, imagine being, maybe some of you are pathologists. To a pathologist, life is cells. You know, the little tiny things, are they organized or are disorganized? Are there free radicals or all the radicals been harnessed? Is the body healthy, is the body ill? When you observe organisms as individual cells, there's very little beauty. When you see the harmony, when you see the synchrony, when all those cells fall together to an incredible order, it's the most beautiful thing in the world. A living thing is far more than the sum total of its parts. It's beauty, it's elegance. And frequently we get so caught up in counting the trees, we cease to see the forest, we cease to see the beauty, we cease to see the unity. And it's true in Yiddishkeit, it's true in our daily lives. And Kabbalah brings beauty into everything you do. I put on tefillin this morning. In fact, I put on two pairs of tefillin. And I did it yesterday and the day before. The day before that, I skipped. It's a Chabad custom to skip Shabbos, right? How many times have I put on tefillin in my life? Thousands of times. Thousands of times. Same act. Same exact ritual. Read the same words, more or less. And it's part of our religion. This is we don't believe in symbols. Judaism does not believe in symbolic acts. We believe in holy acts. There's godliness in the act itself. There's godliness in that parchment as it's been prepared and made ready for the performance of divine commandment. And Kabbalah makes it beautiful. It interprets it in a way makes it feel beautiful means it's part of something much, much bigger. There is the supernal man, you know, the anthropomorphic mystical model, which is beautiful and whole. And tefillin are a piece. The 613 commandments. Each commandment is part of a whole. And when you partake, when you engage, when you invest in any aspect of Judaism, you're not just doing a little thing. It's a piece of a symmetry. It's a piece of a wholeness, which is incredibly beautiful. And when you occupy yourself with the do's and the don't do's, and I want to make this clear, okay? Orthodox Jews, religious Jews, the center of their lives is the law, is the mitzvahs. It's not Kabbalah. Even us wacky Chabad Hasidim, with all of our idiosyncrasies and our shtick, with our Hasidus and with our Kabbalah, the center of Judaism is the it's the practical life, doing the mitzvahs. But having the spirit, having the soul, having the Kabbalistic enlightenment, it makes Judaism beautiful. You don't just see cells, you see a living thing. Yiddishkeit becomes a living thing. The mitzvahs don't become burdens, and the same thing again and again and again. They're part of a beautiful thing. And people Kabbalah because they want to find beauty. They want to find beauty in the world. They want to find beauty in the purpose of the world. They want to find beauty in themselves, in their personal lives, in their familial lives, in their struggles. And they want to find beauty in Yiddishkeit. Now, I'll get to you in a moment. I will get you in a moment. Pardon?
You should probably ignore me.
You think so? Thanks for the counsel. You look wise enough for me to listen to on this particular occasion. I want to tell you a story. My father told me the story. Apparently the story happened in the 1950s. Precisely how the story happened, I don't know. But the story is true. It's a true story. A medical doctor, a scientist, whose entire investment, intellectual investment, was in anatomy, in human biology, did what Einstein would call a thought experiment, a mental experiment. He resolved to consciously go through every step that the body goes through as it moves. I just raised my hand. How many things happen? There's a message from my brain to my spine, from my spine. It's so incredibly complex, and it's moving at the speed of light. So it's instantaneous in real terms, in the real world. And this scientist decided that he's going to consciously, you know, what we call reflex, natural function of any living thing. You don't have to pay attention. He decided to do it deliberately, on purpose. He's not going to raise his leg until he goes through that mental process of visualizing the message from the, you know, from his brain to the back of his brain, to his spine, to his thighs. I don't know. I'm not a biologist. I'm not an anatomist. But you get the picture. And the man became immobile. He couldn't move. He had to relearn to walk. Now, exactly how the story occurred, in other words, the particular story, I don't know. I tried to research it. But the principle, it's a true story. And it reveals something. It reveals something very, very interesting. What it reveals is that in order to function as a human being, you have to take humanness for granted. When you make being a human being into a machine, it doesn't work. When as we take our humanness for granted, we're allowing ourselves to be organic, beautiful, not mechanical. We're just living. We're not paying attention to the fact that we're living. We're just living. And if we choose to insist on seeing it, we actually slow ourselves down. We were kids. 14-year-old Yeshiva Bachrim with an attitude. So what's new? I went to learn in L.A. for the summer. I got stuck there for 3 years. But I went for the summer. I went to Disneyland. You heard of Disneyland, right? In the 1970s, going to Disneyland costed $11.95. I think now it's $119.50. And you got this little book of tickets. An A ticket and 2 B tickets and 3 C tickets and 4 D tickets and 5 E tickets. And you could pretty much keep yourself busy all day with that book of tickets. But you had to sit and figure out what you're going to do. Now they give you one of these bands and they charge you $65. So you have to use your tickets. Jew's not going to waste a ticket. So on Main Street, they have a theater. It's an A ticket, which is pretty useless. You walk into this theater and you sit down. And Abraham Lincoln gets up and makes the Gettysburg Address. This Abraham Lincoln is a machine. It's not a person in a costume, it's a machine. And they give you this whole introduction how Walt Disney was obsessed with the idea of duplicating life mechanically. And they have a film of him with a bird chirping. And it's, this guy, this Abe Lincoln's pretty good. And if you go to Los Angeles, I don't know what's going on in Disney World, I've never afforded myself a trip there. You can go on Main Street, I think, Abraham Lincoln, you know, maybe, probably still there unless they moved him. And he gets up and he makes the whole speech, you know, 80 years ago, about the Union and so forth. And we, Yeshiva Bachers, were determined to prove that he's a machine and not a man. You know, that's all we did. We didn't allow ourselves to enjoy the speech. That would be boring. We wanted to identify the machine as opposed to the organism. And it was very difficult to identify, easy to identify if you paid attention. This Abraham Lincoln moved his head, he blinked, he nodded. It was incredibly sophisticated. And he raised his hands and he raised his voice and he lowered his voice. Where did you see that this was a machine and not a man? When he lowered his hand. How do you lower your hand? If Abraham Lincoln would lower his hand, it would have fallen off. So his hand came down like this. Living things are beautiful because they take themselves for granted. There's beauty in everything. Unfortunately, so many things don't find beauty. In Yiddishkeit, many people, unfortunately, sometimes find frustration. And Kabbalah reminds us of the beauty of Yiddishkeit, the beauty of life. Because that's what it does, it paints a picture. Everything is a part of a whole. Nothing is isolated. Nothing is by itself. It's a part of a greater whole. And beauty is comforting. Beauty is it makes us feel very good. It makes us feel very purposeful. And I just want to mention that people who study Kabbalah, beyond just reading a couple of self-help or modern works on Kabbalah, will find that Kabbalah is quite tedious. It's incredibly technical. And yet, in some kind of a strange way, in spite of the fact that it's very technical, there's a lot of mathematics in Kabbalah, there's beauty in it. And if you get caught up in the world of Kabbalah and you become a technician, you've taken the beauty out of Kabbalah, it's in effect taking Kabbalah out of Kabbalah. So this is another thing that I think draws people to Kabbalah. They want to see beauty, lives, and their religion, and their mitzvahs, their Shabbos, their kosher. The fourth item that I want to share is the T word. Truth. Is there truth? Judaism says yes. So that's my opinion. Why? Because I'm brainwashed. And I don't mind. It's okay. Don't feel bad for me. Some say the rabbi is brainwashed also. The rabbits, I don't know. I haven't met it yet. Is there something as an absolute truth? Truth. Truth means that this is not a matter of opinion or interpretation or what you see, but what's real. What real means, if I look at it this way, I'm not seeing it. If I look at it a different way, I'm going to deny it. But truth doesn't change. Religion in general, at least in principle, is about the idea of truth. Kabbalah is the pursuit of the truth. The pursuit of the truth means I don't just want to believe it. The point that you made before. I want to have a sense of it. I want to have a sense of what's real. What's true. I remember being a kid. And my father's a rabbi. My father's been he spent his whole life, his adult life, his working life as a computer programmer, an analyst. But he's a rabbi. And now he's retired and he's only a rabbi. He was always a rabbi. He was a rabbi in front of whatever it was. In the 1970s, computers were a size of house. He worked on computers. But he's a good Jew, my father. And he's helped a lot of people in his life. And I was a kid. And the job of children is to bother adults, in case you didn't know. That's just what they were designed to do. What adults are supposed to do about it is a different discussion. And so we used to mess with the guys, you know, my brother and I, we were troublemakers. And now they make fun of us, those white-bearded Jews who, when we were kids, they were newly married, starting their own lives and families. And there was a guy in the shul who I know quite well, very sincere fellow. And he was pretty square. He wasn't, He wasn't into Kabbalah. But he had a heart. And it was Simchas Torah. And he got pretty happy. The poor wife was so embarrassed. It wasn't good. Anyway, but he said L'chaim one time too many, or two times too many, or 10 times too many, whatever it is. But he was on the other side of self-control. And, he had self-control. But he was out of the side of... He's a man who doesn't speak above a whisper. He's the sweetest guy. And I remember him sitting there, and he was preaching to my father. And what he was preaching to my father is what my father should preach to him. And I'll save the Hebrew and the Yiddish, because it's not going to help anybody. You have to tell me the truth, and don't adulterate it, and don't compromise it, and don't give me... I want you to tell to me the way it is. I once went to speak someplace. It was one of the most embarrassing experiences I had in my life. I was a young schnook. I was married a couple of years. And, I was dabbling in the idea of traveling around, making speeches, inspiring people. And I went to some place. I didn't talk about Kabbalah, but I talked about this concept of tikkun and adam olyon, a much narrower concept. And a woman, who could have been my mother, is sitting in front of me, and I'm carrying on and on and on. I'm not going on, talking to me. Entertaining myself, I don't know about the people, but I thought I was interesting. And this woman starts to cry, but hysterical. And then she just loses it. You're lying to us. And I thought, okay, what am I supposed to do? A woman is sitting here lying. You rabbis from Brooklyn, you don't tell us the whole truth. You only tell us what you want us to hear. We want to hear the whole truth. And she went, it was very interesting to me. It was very moving. I mean, it was weird. It was funny, I have to be honest. But at the same time, it was very moving. Yiddishkeit says there's truth, there's emes. And we want to have a connection to the emes. We don't want to just go through our lives doing things, which is incredible in itself. Being an Orthodox Jew, doing God's commandments is a wonderful life. But you want a connection to the soul of it, to the spirit, to the emes of it. And Kabbalah, or Hasidus, Kabbalah, it tries to give you a sense of that little emes. I was in Moscow 22 years ago. It wasn't so dangerous, but I'm proud to say it was there before the communists fell. And I was in there's two synagogues in Moscow. The Lubavitch Synagogue, which then was an old shack, and now it's a palace. And the central synagogue, the Chor Shul, which is a beautiful shul, it's still a beautiful shul. It's from before the revolution, it's a very old building, it's a beautiful building. And there was an old Jew there, Alta Yidl, who came from Avich Stock. He never left Russia, lived in Moscow his whole life. And he had this shtick. One of the prayers we say in the davening is in Aramaic. It's called B'rich Shemei. I'll skip the details, okay, because they could be quite boring. It's a quote, it's a passage from the Zohar, which we read several times a week, B'rich Shemei. And in the B'rich Shemei, you repeatedly say the word K'shoit. 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 K'shoit means truth. Truth. Here was this Moscovite, this Orthodox Jew who knew Judaism from way back. And he couldn't even talk to people. He couldn't even share his religious feelings with the people who came to shul, because you didn't know who was friend and who was foe. But he would say kshoit. The whole shul heard him say kshoit, because he knew that no one knows what the word means. You understand? No one knows what I mean. Kshoit! And every rabbi who showed up from America, including myself, I was a young kid, I was 22 years old. You hear a guy say kshoit, the whole room say kshoit. Ooh, interesting. So I shouted him back, And he was so thrilled that somebody understood him. You understand? This was a person who for 50 years had been coming to people saying, shite! Shite! There's truth! He couldn't afford to say it in Hebrew. He couldn't afford to say it in Russian, so he said it in Aramaic, shite! And when somebody got it, and apparently I wasn't the only one, because I read about it in articles, people would come back from Moscow, I met Mr. Shait, and when you would acknowledge Shait, it was so meaningful to him. Somebody understood, emes, truth. There's a story, a Lubavitch story, a story that's close to home. I hope you'll appreciate it, because I love this story. There was a Jew who passed away around 20 years ago. His name was Reb Heschel Tzeker. lived in Montreal. He was a very interesting fellow. A Chassidish Yid, a Jew who went through hell. Hitler, Stalin, the worst, he survived. He lived in Montreal, he was a Shaykhet, like a fashion, a ritualist lawyer. And he was a Chassidish and a Shom. He Chabrengi said a lot of Lachayim. But he was one of those Jews that the more he drank, the more beautiful he became. You know, people drink to get ugly. He was a Chassid. He didn't drink during the week, but when he had a Chabrengi, Chassidim, so he said Lachayim. So he was here once in New York, Simchas Torah, a long time ago, the early 60s. And his little boy, who was now a big rabbi in Tzfas, Aaron Lazer, was with him. And it was Simchas Torah in the morning, and he was in a very, very inspired mood. And he says to his little son, who was now, we're going to the Rebbe. Now, it's hard for me to describe to you what it means going to the Rebbe. If we had time, we can start asking, how many of you have met the Rebbe? But by Hasidim, you don't just go over to them and say, hi Rebbe, how are you? It's just not the way it is. And a person like that, especially, doesn't just march into the Rebbe's room and say, hi Rebbe, I came to bother you. But it was the right day, it was the right mood, it was the right time, so he schleps his kid with him upstairs and he waits. The Rebbe finishes davening. Davening from Chassid is very long, finishes at 2:15, 2:30 in the afternoon. The Rebbe comes upstairs. And on Simchas Torah, the Rebbe's face shone like the sun. Everybody who met the Rebbe, Simchas Torah, felt like he was incredibly close, full of love and full of giving. Simchas Torah was very close. And I always tell people, Rosh Hashanah, I felt the Rebbe is very far away. Simchas Torah, the Rebbe is my, he just loves, he's so close. The Rebbe comes upstairs, walks into his, he unlocks his door, goes into his room, and the Rebbe Eshel Teitel follows him in with his little boy. And the Rebbe turns around, he's got company! And the Rebbe smiles, and when the Rebbe smiles, his whole face lit up, and says, Rebbe Heschel. And the Rebbe didn't say, get out of here, I'll call the cops. No, he said, Rebbe Heschel, it was a little kid. What do you want? And he must have been quite inebriated. He must have been quite over the top. He says, Rebbe, ich will dien dem Eibishn chotsch mit a bissel emes. Which means, Rebbe, I want to serve God with a little integrity, with a little emes, a little truth. And he bursts into tears. And the little boy is wondering, exactly what did my father do wrong? What's he crying about? Nobody died. He's a deep person. I wanted a little truth. And the Rebbe raises his hand, he's a bissel emes, a sach emes. Why a little truth? Loads and loads of truth. It's a story. To me, it's a meaningful Chabad story. Now finally, one last thing, and I'll let everybody go. I think people are interested in Kabbalah because they want to know what the blank am I doing? Why do I exist? What's my purpose? And of course, in a world that believes that we're all an accident, the answer to that question is, who cares? Eat, drink, and be merry. But somehow, some of us, or all of us, or many of us, are not satisfied with that. Why? What are we doing? Why do we exist? And religion provides answers. Kabbalah provides spiritual answers, meaningful answers, deeper answers. And a lot of people say, teach me. What's life about? Why are we here? Why do we exist? What's our purpose? And it's probably one of the most credible reasons to learn Kabbalah, because you want Kabbalah to teach you how to live your life behaviorally, based on a purpose. I'm here and I'm supposed to get there, as opposed to just doing whatever I want. Having what we call in our culture of opportunity, experiences. So I'm going to say 2 points, and then I'm going to let you all go. Unless, of course, you want to harass me. In which case, I'm going to let myself go. No. Okay. This is how I'm going to put it to you. This is my closing remark. We and God have got an ongoing disagreement. Creation, beings that have a concept of spirituality and our Creator are in perpetual dispute. Okay, and that's not a bad thing. Don't argue, done. It's not a good idea. You're not going to win anyway. Right? The argument is simply this. God has created us, which means He's given us our own identity. We're separate from God. The center of my universe is myself. And as spiritual beings, we want to reunite with God. In mystical terms, the human interest in existing on this planet is to rise, to go up, to get close to God. And getting God has a cost. It means I don't care so much about things that are not that important. God has a different interest. God's interest is, I created you to import me, that we should bring God down. God's interest is not that we should get close to Him, but that we should bring Him to His world. To every point of it, every corner of it, every crack and every crevice, the most ungodly, the most remote, the most obscure points in God's world, God says to man, it is your duty to godify. So our interest is to raise ourselves. God's interest is to import Him, to bring Him. Both of those ideas comprise mysticism. Kabbalah teaches us the balance of those two priorities. How a man, a person, brings himself close to God. And from that intimacy, from that closeness, he gets the strength to change the world. How, in order to be able to change the world, you have to, at least in some place in yourself, be above it. Because you can't fix a problem when you're a part of it. And that balance, that dichotomy, is a very special part of what Kabbalah is. So I've given you some things to chew on, some thoughts. I would like to say to you, in conclusion, that in the really basic Chabad tradition, if you want, if you like mysticism or you're curious about mysticism, at whatever level, if you want Kabbalah to be real, do a mitzvah. Mitzvahs are boring and they're dry and they're technical. But mitzvahs are magic with godliness. And when we do what God wants, the spirituality has an anchor. And it germinates, it grows. In other words, Kabbalah without Judaism, Kabbalah without practical Judaism, is impoverished, it's poor, it's sad. You don't even appreciate it. Okay, so call this an evening. And if the good rabbi approves, we can get together on a different occasion. Okay, and just in the short term, I had kosher v'samech to the kosher and happy Pesach. And a good night to all of you. Okay, good night. Good night. Yeah, my cab is waiting for me, but yeah. Zu gesund. Your name again?
Oizer Dala Moshe.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, if you like what you just heard, I've got a website. Everybody is promoting something. I want you to understand, my website is perhaps for the more initiates, a little bit scholarly, and a lot of Yiddish and Hebrew, but you can find a lot of material that you would enjoy. The name of the website is East, in English.
Yeah,
based on the
kind of... What's it called?
I have it at my house. Somebody sent
Thank
it.
Thank you very much.
God bless you, yes.
And if you have questions, please bother.
Okay, let me just see if my ride is outside.
You recorded it?
What? Yeah, I recorded it. Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Super, beautiful, nice to
beautiful,
meet you.
Beautiful, very good.
I'm sorry I didn't...
I thought I heard a few subtleties that I didn't hear before. We didn't learn it in Kabbalah. We talked about why people are interested in Kabbalah. And I think that it's helpful to start having to be talking about this stuff. I felt a little rudimentary for what I'm thinking. I don't know what else to say on the matter. I was thinking about it. I mean,
I think you want to stimulate people to start looking at
interest.
I know I can't.
What?